This episode is brought to you by The Manor, a premier addiction treatment facility in the hills of Wisconsin's Kettle Moraine Forest. Their program offers a tailored approach to those struggling with addiction in a secluded setting with no more than 11 men and women. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love are struggling with addiction, call The Manor at 414-930-1930. That's 414-930-1930. You can learn more about The Manor by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting discoverthemanor.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are. Falling squares on TV
screens, still falling apart. I'm Erica C. Barnett, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for listening. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity, episode 85. It's hard to believe I've done 85 episodes. Got some exciting stuff coming up for episode 100. Have artwork by Heather Sundquist Hall, who was featured in episode 43, Austin, Texas-based artist. She painted a little cover for me depicting what she sees as the path to authenticity, and that's going to be the cover art for episode 100, which will come out in early to mid-December. And it's also going to be available for sale, so pretty excited about that. I've been doing a lot of reading lately, which I like to do, but I've really been intentional about at least spending a good part of the weekend, every weekend, doing some reading, trying to stay off the computer and my phone for at least an hour in the morning, do a little bit of reading, and stay off my laptop all day on Sunday and just read, rather than getting stuck in cyberspace. So anyway, I've been reading a biography by Timothy Egan, who's a writer for the New York Times. He wrote a biography called Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis, who was an artist at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, wanted to document to the best of his ability the Native American tribes, their culture, and, you know, lots of just beautiful photographs that he took. So it's his story. Then I've been reading a book on writing by Chuck Palahniuk, the novelist who wrote Fight Club. It's called Consider This, and it's probably, I've read a number of books on writing, and it's very practical, useful stuff that you know, I just picked up immediately in the beginning of the book. So I'm excited about that. And then another book that I've really enjoyed is the book Quitter by Erica C. Barnett, who is the guest for this episode. a memoir of drinking, relapse, and recovery. I talk about how I found the review for this book in the New York Times Book Review and tracked her down, and she was kind enough to come on the show. And as soon as I started reading it, I was happy I did. So you're going to get to hear all about Erica, the process of writing this book, what recovery has been like for her. She's a journalist living and working in Seattle. So we had a great conversation. Hope you enjoy it. Erica C. Barnett.
Just the product of some bad seeds. Just some guys.
Erica, how are you?
You know, that's always such a weird question these days, but I am good. Good. I'm really good. I'm about to take some time off, so I'm especially good because I haven't had a lot of time off in the last 6 months or so.
Well, and I assume that's because you just published your book. And first of all, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate you investing the time in this. And you know, I reached out to you. I don't know. When did your book come out? Maybe a month ago at this point?
It came out in July, and we're talking near the end of August.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, I saw the review of it in the New York Times Book Review on Sunday, and I thought, I need to reach out to her. So, I tracked you down, and here we are. So, why don't you tell the folks about your book?
Sure. So, my book is called Quitter, A Memoir of Drinking, Relapse, Recovery. And it is, you know, it's about my experiences as an alcoholic who spent 6 years or so trying to quit and relapsing and trying again until I quit drinking for this period of sobriety is the longest I've had in my life since high school. And so it's been about a little under 6 years now. So the book just kind of covers, you know, what all my relapses were like, what they taught me, my time in kind of the trenches of the treatment industry and what I learned and the sort of philosophy, I guess, of addiction and recovery that I have developed through my own experiences and through, you know, observing the experiences of others that I've met on this journey.
Well, and another thing you did that I admired is how you kind of set the stage for how you evolved into an alcoholic, you know, from childhood, really.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of women now and girls start drinking much, much younger than they did when I was, you know, a young girl drinking. Mm-hmm. So I thought I was really, really, you know, advanced and I guess sophisticated for my age. I started drinking when I was about 13. And mostly, I mean, my experience with drugs and alcohol as a kid and as a young adult were mostly around drugs. And I didn't love drinking. And I really, you know, I quit drinking when I was in high school, as I mentioned, and didn't drink through college really. Because it wasn't my thing. I was very achievement oriented. And you know, it just didn't appeal to me and I didn't like the way it made me feel. So the other thing that I write about in the book, sorry for the pause there,
okay.
Was, you know, is the fact that I started really drinking heavily when I was in my late 20s and early 30s, which is surprisingly really common among women. I mean, there is sort of the trajectory where you start drinking as a young child and never stop. But there's also a lot of women who, you know, because of the pressures that you face, you know, when you're in your late 20s, early 30s, you know, kind of trying to build your professional life, maybe have a relationship, maybe have kids, women start drinking and they fall into, you know, these patterns of habitual drinking that can lead to alcoholism if you're predisposed that way. And for me, I was working in an industry. I'm a journalist, and I was working in an industry where drinking every single day was just kind of the norm. And I was very uncomfortable in my own skin. I felt like an imposter. I was really young when I started working in journalism. And, you know, I rose through the ranks pretty fast. And I felt very uncomfortable. And one of the cures for feeling uncomfortable is to take yourself out of a situation, you know, mentally and emotionally. And that's what drinking did for me. And so, you know, the first time I tried to get sober was in 2008. So I was 30 or 31 years old. I think I was 30. And I'm 42 now. I have a little under 6 years sober. So you can do the math. It took me a long time. You know, from first realizing like, okay, this is a problem I need to deal with and thinking it would be easy to actually getting sober like 6 years later, a little more than 6 years later. And that is like, and so just that compressed little period of time is when my real drinking, got going and the kind of nature of my, my addiction became apparent to me.
Well, and you know, one of the things I've kind of been taught, I mean, I don't have firsthand knowledge because I'm not a woman, but you know, for women drinking who have problematic relationships with alcohol or drugs, it tends to be a little more relational than it is for guys. And like you talk about, I mean, a lot of the habitual drinking at that time in your life came about because you wanted to be a part of a group of men who were kind of, you know, running the paper and right. I mean, you were trying to get in.
Well, and it's also, you know, I worked in the alt weekly world, which, you know, I don't know how old your listeners are, but it old was enough. A big deal in the '90s. Just trust me. And so I used to work some, basically until I quit my job at the last weekly paper I worked at, The Stranger. You know, I worked in the alt weekly world, the free weekly world. And, you know, there are definitely women in that world. You know, it's not perfectly gender balanced, but, you know, the balance of power is definitely towards men. My bosses were typically men. And the women that I saw doing really well were the women who, you know, could basically drink the guys under the table. And I wanted to be one of those women. And at the same time, I also, like, you know, I felt like a fraud. Like, I felt like, well, I'm not as cool as these people, or I'm not as educated as these people, or I don't have as much experience. And being a drinking buddy of somebody is a way to just to feel a little more equal to them, I think. And it's not to say that I was a fraud or that I, you know, wasn't cool. I mean, you know, it's fine not to be quote unquote cool too. But I never felt comfortable. And so it was very much feeling, making myself feel comfortable around other people. So as you said, relational.
Yeah. Well, and you know, honestly, I was drawn to your book because you're a journalist and, you know, having some writing experience myself. And one of the things I was taught, and I believe, is that there are certain things that are written about so much that it's hard to stand out, and like a love poem or a love song. And in order to do it effectively, you really have to come at it from a different angle. You kind of have to have a level of mastery to do it effectively, you know? And I feel that way about books like yours, because there are a lot of people who write books about their journey into recovery or their trials and tribulations before. But usually, I mean, if I don't know they can write, then I'm probably not going to read it. And my favorite one of all that I've read was Pete Hamill's A Drinking Life.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just incredible.
I think too, like as a journalist, like I know that, you know, I wouldn't pitch a story if I didn't have, a unique angle. You know, I'm a freelancer. And so that's kind of how I think. And so I wouldn't pitch my own story if I didn't think it was something that, not that it's unusual to have experienced a lot of relapses and also feel that, you know, I have learned from each of those relapses and that they weren't failures. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I know a lot of people feel like that, but it's not something that I've read. And so I kind of, you know, I felt like, well, I have an angle, you know, I guess, on my own life that, that I think just is not represented. And I don't know if it's because of the shame that's associated with relapse for a lot of people, or if it's that like women are not permitted to be kind of the sort of drunk that I was, which is, you know, very sloppy and messy and unattractive and not pretty and all those things. You know, it's not a clean, you know, straight arc from, you know, rock bottom to recovery. But I felt like I had, you know, I could tell the story that was so common to so many people. And I knew that I could, you know, and I mean, I have some confidence in my writing. Of course, this is my first book, so I had no idea if I could write 100,000 words. So
is that, you know, what it was, 100,000 words?
Well, I think the first draft was like 125,000. And I think now it's somewhat below that. I had a great editor who, you know, I'm such a big believer in being edited.
Yeah.
And I love editors because they do things that, you know, I am not particularly skilled at, like seeing things that are duplicated or, for example, seeing entire people that, you know, kind of make the same point as somebody else so you can cut them.
Right.
And, So I had a great editor who cut it way down, but yeah, it was very long at first.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's on like, it's on a great imprint too. I mean, it's Viking, you know, for your first book. It's funny. I had a guest a while back. She has a podcast. It's called Dear Young Rocker. And she went to college and got an MFA in creative writing, and she wrote a memoir. And she can write, you know, and she took it around and pitched it to a lot of different publishers. And finally, somebody just told her, you know, if nobody knows who you are, it's really hard to get a memoir published.
And yes.
So the fact that you got it done on a major publisher, you know, I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I had help along the way. I have friends who've written books, and so they were able, you know, I mean, there's like a little secret network in every profession, I think. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I called all the women I knew who had written books and said, "How did you do it?" And I followed in their footsteps, and, you know, and I didn't just sort of try to figure it out on my own, because I don't think, I mean, the publishing industry is really tough. It's tough to break into. And like, and yeah, nobody knows who I am. I mean, outside of Seattle. And so, you know, so I took a lot of advice. And I took it, you know, pretty slow. And I just did everything people suggested. I mean, it's a little like AA in a way, you know, I was like, well, you know what you're doing. I don't know what I'm doing.
Let me just follow you. Yeah. Well, you also, the title's great too. I mean, I really like the title. Yeah, which is...
I sold it under a different title that had a profanity in it, and then I chickened out.
So are you willing to share with us what that was?
Oh, yeah, sure. It was going to be called Shit-Faced.
Oh, okay.
Which, you know, ended up not exactly fitting the book anyway. And also, I was like, well, what I kept thinking were two things. Do I want my grandparents... Yeah. To be horrified just by the cover. I mean, they're going to be horrified by what's in it. But, and do I want it to sell at like Walmart and Target? And, you know, and of course, like, I don't want to cut out any potential readers or buyers. So, and I think the title Quitter is actually a better title and describes the book much better.
Yeah. That's, you know, especially the relapse process and, you know, it fits really well, I think. So
yeah, it's a process of quitting over and over and over again. Mm-hmm.
So you also have, a website would you describe it as an online publication?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's so coming out of, at the risk of, you know, making this too drawn out, coming out of Alt Weeklies, we decided, a friend of mine and I from The Stranger decided we wanted to start a website. And, you know, that kind of does the same things that alt weeklies do, but a little less snarky and juvenile. So we started a website called Publicola. That turned into ultimately, what I do now, which is a website called The C is for Crank. And, you know, I started that website right after I got sober. And, we're getting ready to actually rebrand it. And when is this going to run?
In a couple weeks. I mean, I can time it.
Well,
if you want, we
the
can
reason
figure that
I,
out.
I've just, well, I mean, this isn't like particularly germane to the topic, but we are in about 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, we're going to rebrand it back to the original site name, which is Publicola. Yeah, I mean, it's basically a local news site. I am a really deeply sourced local Seattle reporter. I've been doing it for a little over 20 years out here in Seattle. Lately, I cover homelessness a lot, and I cover addiction quite a bit because, you know, it's obviously an interest of mine. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I mean, crazily, which is not what I ever would have expected. And kind of the reason the site has a silly name is because I didn't realize it would become, you know, my full-time job in my life.
Yeah.
And now it's like, it's amazing. I mean, I have an employee. Like, what? Yeah. I never would have thought that that was possible.
So I wanted to ask you, what is why the C is for Crank? What's the significance of that?
Oh, boy. So basically, the reason, the explanation behind the title, when I worked at The Stranger, and one of the reasons I left kind of the alt-weekly publishing world and The Stranger specifically is because people would get in the comments, like comments were a really big thing back in the mid, late 2000s. And they would just be like real assholes to me in particular. And my middle initial is C in my byline. Mm-hmm. So it's Erica C. Barnett. And they would like speculate about what the C stands for. And you can imagine all the things they said. Yes. And it was just like this running joke on The Stranger's website. What horrible thing can we call Erica today? And so I started a column at Publicola when I left The Stranger called The C is for Crank. And it was basically just my cranky opinions about things in the city. Mm-hmm. And so crank does not refer to the drug. See, this is part of why I need to rebrand, because it is a very
confusing
title. Yeah. But it's also been around for 6 years now, almost, and so people are a little used to it here in Seattle.
Okay, I like Publicola.
I know it's a good name.
It is a good name.
My friend, I can't take credit for it. My friend Josh came up with it. He's the person that my book is dedicated to.
And was turned out to be a very big person in your life, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He's probably like the main character in the story besides me, because he's the one person who was kind of there through all of it, except for, you know, my parents. But of course, they live in Houston. So he had a real front row seat to everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting, the way the relationship evolved is it would be something that a reader would like to read about, I think, you know. I started to talk about it and I thought, I don't want to give this away. They should read the book, right?
Yeah, we have he is my great friend.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and all of us who go through things like this have those people, you know, who show up for us. And when I say all of us who go through things like this, I mean, I've really come to believe that for me, it was alcoholism, but everybody has something, you know, and there's so much shame associated with addiction, and a tendency to look down upon ourselves. And there are certain mutual support programs that in some ways kind of reinforce that shame. But, but I really believe I am no different than any other human being. We all have wounds. We all have ways that we figure out how to manage our distress. And for me, that was alcohol until it became problematic, you know?
Yeah. One really positive thing that I have noticed over time is that, like, I have a lot of coping tools that I didn't have before. And one of them is just kind of the ability to put things in perspective. And I think a lot of that did come from going to meetings and listening to people's stories, because I mean, what's crazy about my life now is that, like, I am the patient person of all my friends.
Oh yeah.
And if you had known me, I mean, even, you know, 20 years ago before I was even drinking, like, you know, or 15 years ago, I had no patience for anything. I would get so aggravated and like throw things and just throw tantrums. And now, like, you know, last Friday, my wallet got stolen and I was very irritated for about 5 minutes. And then I just kind of thought, well, you know, I mean, people's wallets get stolen every day. You can call all these companies. It'll probably take you about 15 minutes and then you can go on with your life and it's fine. And probably, you know, whoever, because, you know, I found out because somebody had stolen a bunch of money from my cards and just taking that on cash. And I just thought, you know what? Maybe they needed that cash today. Yeah. Like, and I feel like that is a very AA attitude, at least among the people that I know. And it's not an attitude I had before I started kind of just talking to people and getting their perspective on their lives after recovery.
Well, and you know, the ultimate benchmark for me, you know, like I can say the same thing, the exact same, but you know, it's like when you've been where I've been and went through, like, I had to be stopped. I could not stop drinking. I had to be stopped. And to, like, if I can get through that and get to the other side, like, nothing else is really that big a deal.
Exactly.
For the most part. So the perspective that you're talking about, that's where, and it's just kind of happened naturally that I don't freak out about stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think about, like, I mean, I still have drinking dreams, like, to this day, all the time. And I think about what it was like when I was drinking still all the time. And when I think about, like, you know, just what a regular day was like, you know, I mean, I was a morning to night, like, all day drinker. And, you know, and even before I lost my job, it was horrible in one way. And after I lost my job, it was horrible in a whole other way, because there was just nothing to stop me from drinking, like, all day long, except when I was passed out. And when I think about what that was like and compare it to, like, you know, what just a really crappy day now is like, I mean, you know, my, for example, the stranger, you know, my old, employer, they threatened to sue me to stop the book from being published at one point. And I am very, I mean, like, I think most rational Americans in our litigious society, I'm very afraid of lawyers, right?
Yeah.
That was a bad day.
Yeah.
But it was not nearly as bad as any just normal random Tuesday before, you know, in the last couple of years before I quit drinking.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you got through that, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, the whole theme of this podcast really is, I feel like the more of us, who do what we actually want to be doing with our lives, the better off we all are, and that we all deserve to do what we want to do. And so, you know, how does this, all of this, fit into your vision for your life and what you wanted for your life and your sense of purpose and meaning? What would you say about that?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, and this is, since my book is about sobriety, you know, I'll talk about sobriety again. I mean, you know, before I got sober and before I even started drinking and before I was even old enough to, like, work at a job of any kind, I had this path laid out for myself where I would, you know, go to school, get good grades, get a scholarship, go to college, get a job in journalism and be a journalist and kind of work my way up whatever ranks I felt like I wanted to work my way up. And, you know, and that's what I did. And I, you know, sacrificed, I guess, everything else to that goal. That was the most important thing to me. And then, because of my drinking and because of my behavior, I lost all that, like all, at, I mean, sort of all at once, in that, you know, I lost my job. I was fired, and I had never been fired from a job before in my life. And I thought my job was everything because I had like made it myself, you know, and then I didn't have that job anymore. And then I, you know, I had to get sober, and then I kind of came out of that. And I think what actually ended up prompting my sort of realization that I could get sober and that I could actually like live a different life than I had been living is just this realization that like you can, you know, within the confines that are created, you know, by society and by whatever your circumstances are, you can do anything with your life. And particularly for me, I could do anything with my life. Like I don't have kids. I don't need a lot of money to live. I mean, I like to have a lot of money to live, but I don't need it. And so I just decided I was going to kind of start from scratch. And what that meant for me was like, I got a job, and it was just a job, working at a nonprofit doing PR communications. And I started rebuilding, you know, my sort of reporting credentials. I started this silly little website that, you know, then one day somebody gave me some advice about how to make some money off it without having to do advertising, which I had seen, you know, the sort of cliff of advertising falling off. You know, that was kind of killing the newspaper industry. And so I, this is a very roundabout way of saying like, I now, you know, today I'm sitting in my house. I work from my couch, essentially. I make plenty of money, you know, to have savings and to have like, you know, an IRA, which is unthinkable before to me. And I also get to cover whatever I want, like anything I want to cover on my website, you know, dictated by, will anybody want to read this? But, right. You know, you don't need that many people to read a website and give you money to make it work. And so, so I now have this life that I would never have had if I had, you know, even figured out a way to moderate my drinking, which I don't think would have been possible after a certain point. But, you know, when I was sort of stuck in the parameters of what I thought was possible, I was going to continue on that same path forever, probably. And so just kind of having that realization, and I remember it really vividly when I just sort of thought to myself, I think I was in detox for the last time, just thinking to myself, you can do anything you want with your life from here on out. And like, and realizing that that was true and then taking action on it. It really, I mean, it's changed everything since then.
Yeah. You know, myself, I recognized early on in my sobriety that one of the advantages I had was there were things I wanted to do. And now, I've talked about this in the podcast a little bit, but the age of onset of alcohol and drug use has changed so much since I got sober. You know, I was in a facility where I was 23. There was probably one other guy in his 20s, and everybody else was like 38 plus. And right. My roommate was 67, and there was an 88-year-old on the unit, you know, like. Now that's an aberration. Everyone is under 25 or 27. It's just different. And I think with that, I encounter so many emerging adult males who they don't even know what they're interested in. That, you know, let
that
alone
also
what
is
the
kind of a sense of possibility too, you know, because It's like you just, I mean, I do, you know, I sometimes wish I had had a little more time, like I had gotten it sooner, but you know, but I also think I got it when I got it, and I got it when it was possible for me. Yeah. But it would have been amazing if I had, you know, somehow been able at 30 to quit like I thought I was going to, but it just didn't work out that way.
Well,
and that's fine, you know. I can't do anything about it.
I was that kid in meetings who, you know, everybody'd be like, I wish I got sober when I was your age. You know, I'd heard that all the time. And I mean, I guess, you know, I was grateful and I am grateful, but also like it isn't great. You know, I mean, it's never great for anybody. Like nobody ever wants to go through this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, and it gets pretty old to be a kid hearing that over and over again. And I imagine a lot more for guys or men or women who don't want to be sober and they're young, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that one thing that I didn't realize at the time that I've realized as I've gotten a little older is like, it is much easier. I mean, it just people my age, I'm 42, and people my age, you know, are just more settled down and the pressure. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is, my God, during the pandemic, I mean, it's, you know, the pressure to kind of always be drinking. I mean, if you are on social media all the time, like I am, is crazy, but you can turn it off. Whereas I think when you're 23, 25, you know, even 30, it is just a lot harder, especially if you're like a white collar person, you know, if you're a lawyer or a journalist or a politician, you know, kind of in those circles. I can't speak for any other circles, but I know that like in my circles, it is very much the norm to just, you know, to just drink all the time.
I mean, that's where people meet people, you know, I mean, and that was a revelation for me was there are people out there who don't drink this way.
There are people who don't drink. There's, right, I mean, I talk about this in my book. There's a huge percentage of the population of America that does not drink and has never drank,
right,
you know, or has only done it occasionally. And I was like, where are those people? Because they're not where I live.
Right. Well, in my family, I mean, it was just what everybody did, you know, the guys, especially some of the women, but the guys, especially. And, it was kind of like, for me, the beginning of my, I wanted to connect with the guys in my life. That's what they were doing.
Yeah.
You know?
And I had the opposite experience. I didn't know anybody who drank, growing up because, you know, I was raised by my grandparents until I was 7 or 8 and they're Baptist, they're Southern Baptists. They don't drink. Mm-hmm. And I never knew anybody who drank until, you know, until I was quite a bit older, but I also didn't know anything about drinking. Like nobody ever taught me, you know, about, you know, the risks. And I don't know that I would have listened because kids don't listen to anything, but you know,
Yeah. No. And I had a blast doing it too. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, it's a lot of fun, but I also, I wouldn't trade this for any.
Yeah. You know? Same. I mean, I had a lot of, I never liked drinking. I'll be honest. Like it made me feel more comfortable, but it always made me feel like crap. When I was, you know, when I was young, what I liked was drugs and I just never got back into them because I knew it was, you know, I mean, I did a lot of psychedelics and I think it would have probably fried my brain had I kept doing them in some way, some form or fashion. But yeah, I mean, but I am much happier overall as a person than, you know, with whatever small sacrifices, it's even a sacrifice of not being able to do that stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, reading your book, you did a lot of acid, like,
yeah,
I'm in my head, I'm like, there's a wine bottle on the cover. Like I didn't expect this turn of like daily dropping acid daily in high school, man.
Yeah, well, it was the '90s and that was the drug.
Yeah.
And you know, and I certainly I don't regret that at all. I wish, you know, that's not a great message and I wouldn't say that to anybody's kid.
But, right. Well,
but when you're a kid in the suburbs and you're good at school, which is not to say like smart, because there are plenty of smart people who are not good at school, but it was incredibly boring for me.
Yeah.
And I still did well despite that, which is, you know, probably, again, this is not a lesson for anybody's child.
Yeah.
It is a bad way to structure your life, but
well, and
for
you
me,
know,
it didn't turn out that bad.
One of the things I love about sobriety, and I'm sure you can say this at this point, like I can look back on it now and it all makes sense.
Yeah.
And even not only that struggle, other struggles in my life, you know, every job I've ever had led to the next job. every struggle I had, I got through it. I was stronger, healthier, whatever, you know, back to the perspective thing. You know, it's one of the coping skills we get from this is the ability to just kind of take it all in and experience.
Yeah. Life. I mean, I do want to push back on just one thing though, like, or at least kind of add a bit of context for me, which is like, I never got arrested and I did a lot of stuff that if I was not, you know, if I was Black, if I was visibly Mexican American, my mom is Mexican American, but, you know, I have very pale skin. I would have been arrested like so many times. Yeah. And, you know, even the time I talk about getting caught shoplifting and that was here in Seattle and they didn't arrest me. And I've seen people get arrested for shoplifting. I saw, like, after I got sober, I saw a guy stealing food, a Black guy stealing food at the supermarket. And, you know, two security guards tackled him, threw him down an escalator. And then the cops came and carried him away. And it's like, okay, that would never happen to me.
Yeah.
And so, like, there, I had, like, people lifting me up. And I had, you know, and I had privilege and I had a lot of luck, too. But, you know, and I think that all combined to, you know, to kind of this story that I have now, which is like I was able to learn a bunch of stuff. But I think there's a lot of points when that learning could have been disrupted by the cops, by, yeah. You know, well, probably by the cops, because there's just a lot of stuff I did that I didn't get caught for because nobody was really watching me.
Well, my last night of drinking ended in jail. And my first day of sobriety started in jail. I was arrested a couple times.
You just stayed sober since then. Yeah. Like that was the kick in the pants.
Well, you know, I couldn't stop. There are things I wanted to do in life. And you know, for me, I grew up in a blue collar town in the Midwest and, there were, this part of the reason why I'm doing this podcast is because, in some ways I was discouraged from doing the things I actually wanted to do. And, you know, and one of the things that was literally said to me by a family member in my senior year in high school was, what are you going to do? Work at McDonald's so you can write? I mean, their idea of what was possible just, you know, it was limited to their small life experience.
Yeah.
And so I ended up becoming a union carpenter.
Wow.
Yeah. It was like, get a trade, you know, and back to the authenticity thing, looking back on my life, I can see where every time I got off course, I mean, in some way or another, I was betraying myself. I wasn't being authentic. And, and that is like, it's an existential crisis when you get to the point and to me, that's kind of what this was. Like I was in such distress. That's why I was drinking. Mm-hmm. I needed to change the way I felt.
I think that's such a good point. And like, and this is another place where I feel just like, I was really lucky. I mean, even though like you could look at my life and say, well, you were lucky, but you blew it, you know, I mean, if you stop at, you know, 2014 or so, but like, I mean, my family, like all along, I mean, there were these, you know, perhaps excessively high expectations, which can also, I think, work to people's detriment. It probably did work to my detriment, but at the same time, there was this, you know, if I said I wanted to be a writer, which I did, you know, my grandparents would say, you're the most brilliant writer in the world. And I know you can do it. And, you know, you're going to go to college and you're going to get straight A's and, you know, and they're like working class people too. Mm-hmm. But that was just, you know, the expectation was like, okay, you want to be a writer, you're going to do it. Not like you're going to stay in Mississippi and, you know, work at the JCPenney or whatever.
And that's kind of what it is. And the world I come from, I mean, most people don't leave.
Yeah, same.
I mean, I left to get sober, you know, and I have other family members who never got out of my hometown until they left to go get sober. And and it's such a big world. But, you know, the community, small towns, and mine isn't tiny, but, you know, 50, 75,000 people. But, yeah, it's different. It's just a different way of life.
Yeah. Yeah. My family still lives in Mississippi in the same town that I, you know, that I started out in. And my parents live in Houston because they wanted, you know, a better life and they wanted to get out of Mississippi because there's just not a lot of opportunity there and just not a lot of room, you know, for people who have like big dreams for themselves, you know, I hate to say. And that's not to stereotype an entire state, but in the small town that, you know, that I was from, I think that it's fair to say.
Yeah. Well, I love the way you write. I appreciate you sent me a PDF of the book and you offered to send me one and I actually asked you to sign it for me and you did, which I really appreciate. So I guess the last thing I would ask you is looking back on all of it, is there a particular time in your life when you feel like you'd like to go back to younger Erica and give her some insight about what you know now you didn't know then? What would you say to her and when would that have been?
I think I would have been probably when I was first starting out as a journalist. I was 19 and I lied about my age to all my coworkers. And I said I was 21 because I wanted to be a little bit older and seem a little more sophisticated. I don't know why I thought that a bunch of 35-year-olds would think 21 meant anything.
Yes. That but, is kind of funny.
But I think that kind of started me down a path at that first job of just always feeling a little bit fraudulent and always feeling like I wasn't quite good enough and I needed to do more to prove myself. And I think I would go back and just say, you know, you're enough. Like, you are enough as you are right now. And you don't need to, you know, it wouldn't be about drinking, but it would just be about, you know, it's okay not to know everything because you have a lot of growing up to do and you have a lot of time to do that.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, that's a tough one. Like, I still have my moments of feeling like I'm not enough. I mean, I'm sure you do too. I mean, you know, we're so hard on ourselves.
Yeah. And there's so much, I mean, especially, you know, when you're a woman getting older, you know, you really have to filter out a lot of crap and a lot of crap messages, you know, about your worth. You know, you start to become invisible like around 35 or so. And you have to start, you know, teach yourself to care about different things. And it's, you know, you can definitely internalize those messages or figure out a way to ignore them and counteract them.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate this. I've enjoyed talking and so I want you to keep us in mind and I'm sure there are more books, right?
I certainly hope so. Yeah. I've got a couple of ideas.
You know, you'd be welcome to come back anytime you want and be on again. I'd love to have you on again.
Awesome. But, well, likewise, this was so much fun and I really appreciate your reaching out.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.